today gets more interesting, I think. I think you'll see how what we talked about yesterday, some basic biblical notions, work themselves out in a rather specific way in thinking about the use of force, and especially deadly force. So yesterday we talked about some content for biblical notions of peace, justice, community, and creation. And I want to assume those now and pick them up again only after we've discussed a little bit of a couple of moral traditions in the Christian faith on the use of deadly force. And so we'll pick up our think widths in the course of thinking about that. And then tomorrow the subject is the Roman Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter. It's entitled The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise and Our Response. I think the bookstore is sold out. I checked this morning. I didn't find copies in there. We have had a copy or two on reserve in the library, and in any event, tomorrow I will give you the address, or if you want it today, where you can secure this extremely important document. So the question today is a question about the use of deadly force. Let's just back up and pick it up a little bit of yesterday. In the Hebrew scriptures and the apostolic writing, there is testimony to a great qualitative difference between God's way of peace, or shalom, and our own peace, between the way of the kingdom in the preaching of Jesus and the kingdoms of this present world. So the New Testament language is almost always language about the incompatibility of the present order of things and the way that Jesus says is breaking in upon us in the reality of the resurrection, as in retrospect, and a new community. And the appeal is almost always an appeal to change our ways in a dramatic, change our ways dramatically. There's always a grave tension and real conflict between a disordered or broken or sinful creation and creation being made new. That is the language of the early community of the New Testament, the language of conflict between God's peace and our efforts. And yet we live with both of those realities in both of those worlds. There are signs of redeemed life among us. There's also signs of ever-present death in many forms. The question then becomes, in terms of yesterday's picture, two tasks, two vocational tasks for the Christian. The question becomes, how do we both care for creation in the present, and despite its broken condition, and at the same time witness to new life in Christ? Furthermore, the question is, does that dual responsibility ever ask conflicting tasks of us? Does responsibility in the wider civic community, of which we're all a part in our day-to-day life, ever conflict with a rigorous ethic that is asked of the community of faith as it witnesses to new creation and God's hope? The early church had that question in a very specific form. It was, can a Christian be a soldier? And from that time on, then a debate has gone on, and that's what I want to outline today. And then we'll have more time for discussion today. The debate really isn't about what is the binding moral norm for Christians. That's clear. That moral norm is the de-hostilizing and reconciling love that's embodied in Jesus and is extended to everybody, including the enemy. This dehostilizing and reconciling love is, as we saw yesterday, imitative of God's own character and conduct. God's own love extended while we were yet enemies, to use Paul's language in Romans, and it makes for peace. That is, through the cross, it breaks down the barriers between elements of creation at enmity with one another. But does the call to imitate God's reconciling love ever entail conflicting tasks for us? And Christians of the past have said, yes, it does at times. For surely it means to do the neighbor no harm, including the enemy, and it also means protecting the neighbor from harm, including the enemy. Now, how do you do the neighbor no harm if some neighbors intend harm upon other neighbors? How is it that no neighbor is done harm while yet all neighbors are protected from harm? The love command is clear, but it comes in those two parts. Later in the week, Tom Anderson is going to do a session on police work. And there, that is the reality in a broken world that the policeman is faced with. So the issue raised then becomes a familiar and a perennial issue, namely, what is the proper use of coercion in society? What is the justifiable use of force, if force is necessary for peacekeeping and even peacemaking? And most acutely, the question is killing force ever justified in caring for creation and witnessing to God's hopes for it? Here's the dilemma. If force or its threat is not used by us, or it's not authorized for others to use on our behalf, for the police and the army, for example, then the obligation to protect the neighbor, especially innocent neighbors, from harm might be violated. But if force is used by us, or you authorize it's used by others, then the obligation to do no neighbor no harm, including the enemy, is violated. Well, the world is too much with us. Morally sensitive Christians have agonized over the use of force along two lines, and that's what I'm going to outline as two moral traditions addressing this question. Those lines are the pacifist line and a line that I'm going to call a line of exceptionally justified violence, that is, violence justified only as a moral exception. That, in common parlance, and in the tradition, has been called the just war tradition. I don't like the term for reasons I'll explain, but part of the reason is that it sounds like it pertains only to the question of war, and it's not that. It's a question of the use of killing violence in any kinds of circumstances. So it pertains as much to police work as to war. It even pertains to questions like abortion and euthanasia. It's just about the use of force as an intervention in the situation. Okay, two lines then. Now, both of those lines share some very important agreements, and we must not overlook that. Both uphold the binding moral norm of dehostilizing and reconciling love. That is, both traditions agree that is what should govern our actions. Both of the traditions, pacifist and just war, acknowledge that human society does require some kinds and degrees of carefully authorized coercion, including violence. That's why a lot of pacifists will say, yes, we do need the presence of such as a police force. Society does require some kinds and degrees of authorized coercion. The threat of force is necessary to stave off the anarchy of war, of a kind of war of all against all. And not only that, it's necessary even to attain some of the benefits that we all desire. We want good public roads, we want a good public school system, we want mail service, we want adequate protection or other goods, all of them paid for by taxes, yet, and pacifists know this as well as just war folks, we wouldn't voluntarily provide sufficient revenues if it weren't for the fact that we were threatened with negative consequences unless we did pay those taxes. So even for benefits that we all desire, the threat of coercion in some form or another is a requirement. And both traditions agree upon that use of coercion or its threat as a social necessity in a fallen world. Where the two part ways is here, may we in good conscience ever use killing force? And if ever, in what circumstances? The pacifist says, no, we may never in any circumstances. It's better to suffer this extreme evil than it is to inflict it. Inflicting it violates God's unbounded preciousness conferred upon all creatures. Killing fatally compromises the witness to God's hopes for a harmonious order. Now, besides that argument of the pacifist, that you fatally compromise witness to what creation is intended for, intended toward, the pacifist also usually argues a pragmatic case. Violent means undermine and even destroy peaceful ends, is the line of argument. The awful, the dramatic, the short-term success, maybe, of killing the adversary always invites an escalation of destruction to the highest degree each side is willing to risk and able to endure, and invariably poisons the long-term need to live together peacefully. So the pacifist says use of violent means invariably poisons the very conditions that are required to live together. We're going to have to go on living together. The pacifist would cite the kind of testimony of Lenin and Bradley that we cited yesterday as just but the latest evidence in a very old story, namely that violent means destroy even just goals or ends. Well, defenders of exceptionally justified violence say that we may use killing force when certain rather exacting stipulations have been met. And these have been elaborated over centuries and are reaching back to pre-Christian thinking, especially in Greece. Centuries of just war thinking. Now I want to tell you why I think that's not a good term. It sounds like a presumption that war is just. When the whole force of this moral tradition is to presume that war is unjust unless a certain burden of proof is met. And meeting that burden of proof justifies killing only as a moral exception to the general prohibition against taking life. So that's just why the term isn't very helpful, because it doesn't tell you that you begin with a presumption that war is unjust, and it's only if very exacting stipulations are met that you can think of it as a justified exception. Now, the most recent use of this tradition is by the Roman Catholic bishops in this very important pastoral letter that we'll discuss tomorrow. But I'm going to start that discussion today by just listing the elements of this just war tradition and take them from the Roman Catholic bishops' letter. Incidentally, just to give you a taste of where this is going, the Catholic bishops come out against the present-day policies of not only the Reagan administration, but the Kremlin on the basis of just war tradition. I think you'll begin to see why. William Clark, President Reagan's advisor, wrote a letter of response to the second draft of the bishop's letter when it was clear that the bishops were in clear conflict with the administration, and had it published in the New York Times. The bishops weren't real happy, but because they read it there before they received it in the mail. It's not a wise way to proceed. But anyway, there is a kind of response to that, and we'll get into that tomorrow in the third draft. The bishops had three drafts, and they sent the first two out for widespread response before they drafted the third one so as to be a genuine teaching device of the church. And they made changes in the process. Okay, now, two elements of this tradition of morally justified violence under certain circumstances. There are two elements. There's one element that has to do with the old Latin phrase is jus ad bellum. That just means under what conditions is the recourse to war permissible? When might you think of killing force as a morally permitted means? And then there's another part of the tradition called jus in bello, which has to do with justice in the conduct of war itself. Are there any ways of restraining the use of violence in when it has been resorted to? I'm going to make this quick so that we have time for discussion. You'll realize that these are kind of common sense elements anyway. Just cause. War is permissible only to confront real and certain danger, that is, to protect innocent life, to preserve conditions necessary for decent human existence, or to secure basic human rights. War isn't justified simply for retaliation or revenge or some such thing. One must talk about whether the cause is justified. It must be waged by a competent authority. That is, if you authorize killing violence, it cannot be arbitrary. It can only be done by socially responsible agents. Violence must be used for the common good, and sanctioned not by individuals or by private groups, but only by persons who are charged with responsibility to govern for the public good. That is, act on behalf of others and not simply in their own interest. So you have a criterion of competent authority. This gets very tricky, many of these do, but in situations especially of guerrilla warfare or revolutionary context, who is a competent authority that speaks for the public good in such settings? It must be a matter of comparative justice. That is, an assessment has to be made. Who holds the edge of justice in disputes between adversaries? If you're trying to decide whether you're going to enter into an alliance where a conflict has already taken place, you have to make a decision about where the edge of justice resides. You also have to decide whether the rights and the values involved are of sufficient moral weight in order to override a presumption against recourse to war. There is the matter of right intention. That refers to considerations both of an initial just cause and how peace and reconciliation is pursued, including avoiding unnecessarily destructive acts or imposing unreasonable conditions. There was a big argument during the Second World War of whether something like unconditional surrender was a proper way to pursue the goals of peace and reconciliation. It was very interesting to me. I read old copies of journal, Christianity in Crisis, that was started precisely to rally Christians in the United States to the side of the Allies against Hitler. And Reinhold Niebuhr and others began the journal for that purpose. So it was to break from the pacifists and to argue for the just war tradition. Yet, in the process of the war being carried out, that same journal argued against Roosevelt's policy when it came to a call for unconditional surrender and when it came to a call for saturation bombing and such things. That'll get into something just in just a minute. But it was because it said conditions of unconditional surrender is not a way of pursuing ongoing life with the communities who are going to be the defeated enemy. So that's just one example of right intention. Unnecessarily destructive acts is a second example that has to do with such as saturation of bombing. Okay, then last resort is another criterion by which you decide when killing violence is morally permissible. If there's any other way to attain a just goal without the use of killing or without the use of war, then war is not justified. There are lots of scales here that you use, and these have been elaborated over time. All legal means must be pursued before you consider illegal ones. All nonviolent means need to be pursued, tried, before any violent ones are considered. Of the violent ones that may be considered, non-lethal violence, non-killing violence, should be used before you consider any use of killing violence. Those are scales that you can use as you consider the possibility of a last resort, which is killing violence. And then probability of success, another kind of common sense one, but under the conditions of severe conflict, lots of people don't use common sense. It means something like an irrational resort to force for reasons of revenge or retaliation are not justified, or a hopeless resistance that has no hope of success is not justified. Now, there are circumstances when that's hard to live with, because one can say, I'm going to say no to this oppressor as a matter of human dignity, whether I'm successful or not. Rather than live life on my knees, I'm going to stand up and fight. But this tradition at least says, if there is no probability of success, if it really is a matter of hopeless resistance, then it's not right to take lives. One pursues something else as a way even of preserving and achieving one's dignity. So there has to be a reasonable chance of success.
Does cause some problems for the idea of deterrence, doesn't it? The idea of deterrence being, if an enemy attacks, then of course that enemy will be attacked and it will all be a mess.
In the letter that we'll get into tomorrow, one of the things that rather much shook the Roman Catholic bishops in their hearings, there were widespread hearings, including hearings with Caspar Weinberger and high place administration officials in both the White House and the Pentagon, was that, without exception, the testimony was that if the Soviets did launch a first strike, we would respond with massive retaliation, whether or not there was
any
a chance
sense
of,
or not.
Yeah.
Now, that raises an interesting ethical question, because if you were in the military, maybe you wouldn't do that, but would you say you wouldn't do that? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they do run tests, and there's a certain percentage of the when they run these tests, the officers don't know that it's a test, but they don't fire them. And of course, the idea of a deterrent is not that you will do it, but that the other side believes you will do it. So would the ethical person, or even the pacifist, be there and say, yes, I would do it, but of course I really wouldn't.
Yeah.
it's
That is one of the moral issues, and we'll pick it up a bit in the letter. It became a matter of major debate among the bishops themselves and in the responses that they got from everywhere about the morality of threatening to use something that you have decided is morally wrong.
Now, of course, I think the response is, in the case of a nuclear war, there is such chaos that the response is probably going to be immoral. That's the fact, and that's why we must avoid that. And there are people who would not do that under those in the mayhem and chaos of nuclear war just might do it. And so that does still have a deterrent value in one sense from the people who say it is wrong to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In fact, it may have a stronger deterrent.
Well, actually, we probably can get to some of that today, and we will surely get to that tomorrow, because those are precisely the issues that are taken up in here. The last one is proportionality, and that means that the damage to be inflicted with the use of violence and the costs that are incurred must be proportionate to the good that is expected by taking up arms. That is, it doesn't make sense to say, as was said during the war in Vietnam, it's too bad, but we had to destroy the village in order to save it. The sense of proportionality is that you can't pursue it with these means unless you have reasonable expectation that the good that will come out of it is greater than the destruction entailed in the process. Now that leads directly over to efforts to restrain violence in the conduct of war itself or other situations using killing violence, because in jus in bello, justice in the conduct of war, the effort is to limit deadly means used on the basis of two principles. The one just mentioned, proportionality, destruction and other costs of prosecuting the war must not be more costly than the good reasonably expected to come from it. And then the second one is a very important one for tomorrow's discussion on the bishop's letter, discrimination. That refers to the immunity of certain groups, non-combatants, third parties, neutral parties, neutral nations, for example, certain classes in any population, the elderly, for example, or children, hospital patients, and probably in most circumstances the majority of the civilian population itself. And again, there's a kind of a foretaste, and maybe for our discussion later, both proportionality and discrimination are massively violated if you're talking about weapons of mass destruction. And it's on the basis of those criteria of the just war tradition that the Catholic bishops came to the judgments they did. So the import of all of this tradition is that it has as its focus, the number one, the prevention of war, and number two, the limitation of war if it is resorted to. But I think for our time, what needs to be underlined is what the bishops do underline. I'm quoting now. Traditionally, the Church's moral teaching sought first to prevent war and then to limit its consequences if it occurred. Today, the possibilities for placing political and moral limits on nuclear war are so minimal that the moral task, like the medical task, is now prevention. As a people, we must refuse to legitimate the idea of nuclear war. Such a refusal will require not only new ideas and new vision, but what the gospel calls conversion of the heart. Which brings to mind the now famous saying of Albert Einstein that the splitting of the atom changed everything except our ways of thinking. And thus, he said, we drift toward disaster. The Roman Catholic bishops are saying conversion of the heart. The New Testament word for repentance or conversion is actually a correction or change of mind that issues in change, behavior and conduct. So now we've got a switch, a shift to an all-out effort of this tradition at prevention rather than limitation, because of the character of total war with certain kinds of weapons. So I would say it one other way. True power now is reflected not so much in the capacity to wage war as it is in the capacity to prevent it. That's what would exhibit true national power and security. And that's what we must struggle towards. Now, I'll finish by saying why the pacifist way and why the way of the defender of limited and exceptionally used violence diverge from one another, both in practical terms, that is what to do, and in theological terms, and that'll bring us back to yesterday. The reason goes beyond the dilemma that was mentioned at the outset, namely that love in grim circumstances dictates actions that are often in conflict with one another. That is, when we cannot protect some neighbors without harming others, and you have to make that hard choice. The conflict goes beyond that to some very deep understandings of Christian faith and responsibility. Both the pacifists and the just war advocates know well enough the requirement of coercion in society, but the pacifist says that somebody should incarnate in the clearest possible way and at all costs, including the cost to his or her own life, the nonviolent peace of the new creation. Pacifists argue that the church, as the called out community, which is to reflect unbroken creation as best it can in its own life, has precisely that vocation of witnessing in an uncompromising way to a new order, even though it knows that you're in the midst of an old order that also has to be cared for. The believing community's call isn't anything other than the imitation of Christ as a sign of the abundant life that's intended for all of creation. When nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither will any learn war anymore, when all tears will be wiped away, when death itself will die, and everyone will join in a messianic banquet of shared abundance. That witness to that reality mustn't be compromised. Is there anywhere, the pacifist asks, a community of such uncompromised and credible witness? The pacifist says, this is the church's calling, and the nonviolent cross is the way. Now, the defenders of justified violence usually concede the place for such a rigorous ethic and such unblemished witness. And again, it was interesting to me in reading the old issues of Christianity in Crisis, started by the just war folks, that they always said, we hope the pacifists don't expire as a species. We need that witness. We fail, even in our efforts at trying to get a little better world, if we don't have that reality reflected in a way where we can see what it looks like, the Gandhis of the world. But the church that follows this way exclusively will, the just war Christian says, ironically neglect the care of a disordered, sinful creation that God still loves without condition. To care for the wider world, disordered as it is, unavoidably and regrettably involves the use of deadly violence. The best we can do is employ violence in limited and careful ways, under proper authorization, as a lesser evil in those many cases where every single choice is morally repugnant, where all the choices have come to, because of certain circumstances, are evil, and all of them incur guilt. If we abandon this responsibility, we abandon responsibility for the relative good that is left in creation and that we have to live by. So failure to do the morally necessary is itself unfaithful to a calling of peacemaking and peacekeeping. That's how the just war person sees this. So both of these traditions rest their case then in sincere but very different emphases about faithfulness and responsibility. Once again, the bishop's letter makes an important point, and one I think that we need to spend a little time with as we discuss. Rather than viewing the pacifist and the just war stances as exclusive choices now for the church and for Christians, the bishops appeal to both of them as distinct but complementary elements of a broader strategy for peacemaking and peacekeeping. So to quote, both options find their roots in the Christian theological tradition. Each contributes to the full moral vision we need in pursuit of a human peace. We believe that the two perspectives support and complement one another, each preserving the other from distortion. The two together, then, offer a broad, basic direction for peacemaking. They ally with one another in opposition to some things, and they ally with one another in pursuit of something. I'll just lay that out briefly. They ally with one another in opposition to all weapons of mass destruction. No matter which of these two traditions you come out of, you come out against that. Both of them favor nonviolent alternatives as the means of first and ongoing resort, all except that division of last resort. George Washington has been trying to get a peace academy in this country since his term of office. We don't have one yet. And we've got, what is it, three or four war colleges.
President George Washington?
President George Washington proposed a peace academy. Both just war tradition folks and the pacifists would say, yes, invest at least, no, not at least, more than you do in the preparation for war, in the study of peace. So both of them would see a whole range of efforts at conflict resolution to be pursued that as high priorities. Take $1.5 trillion over the next 5 years and invest it in the pursuit of nonviolent means of conflict resolution. Both proceed from a norm of de-hostilizing love that establishes the basic trajectory of peace. Both of these traditions share a willingness to risk initiatives, including unilateral initiatives in the pursuit of reconciliation. So they have much more in common than they have differences, and that's what the bishops are trying to get at as a complementary strategy. Now, more than this, and I'll finish here, they could become allies in a rather formidable just peace ethic, picking up from yesterday's understanding of peace. And a beginning point there is developing more broad-based nonviolent means of conflict resolutions and institutions that support those, such as a National Peace Academy. Means of protecting and defending people must be found that do not rely upon the means of annihilation. That's a just peace ethic, pursuing that. Now, it's naive to think that injuries wouldn't occur or even that lives wouldn't be lost. They would, in the use of alternative means. But the risks and the costs have to be measured against the almost certain risks and costs of major wars. And you're taking risks either way, but it's a question of which risks are more destructive, probably. But a just peace ethic is more than effective conflict resolution. Shalom reaches to all dimensions of nature, society, and psyche. How should character and conduct be formed? Child rearing, education, that's part of a just peace ethic. How should governments govern? How should science be conducted? How should commerce be carried out? How should education be pursued? How should citizenship be defined? How should the media be supervised? How should human rights be protected, or in some cases granted in the first place? How should basic needs in society be addressed? That's all part of peacemaking and peacekeeping. And we need now in the Christian tradition to turn these two traditions to that comprehensive undertaking, which means peace making and peacekeeping as a genuine Christian vocation everywhere, with the mentally ill, with the raising of the kids, with care for the body, with good business practice, etc. Okay, let me stop there today, and we can discuss this part, and if you want to, we can start getting into some of the details of the Roman Catholic bishop's letter. Yeah.
I think one of my frustrations, and I guess it was a comment about the film last night, is that this dialogue between the pacifist and your just war is never carried out. In other words, when we discuss things and we see films or presentations or whether you march to support something, you're always seeing extremes and the message gets lost. It always gets down to the practicality of we've got to do this, we've got to support the government, we've got to have more bombs, we've got to do this, versus no, it's wrong, it's immoral. And you go off on two different planes and you don't meld these things together like you're talking about. And I guess I'm frustrated because I don't know how to do that.
You brought that up last night, and you got a lot of silence because it so accurately describes the situation without describing the solution.
We've tried this at church a number of times, and we get more polarized.
I want to respond in a couple of ways. Number one, the bishop's letter is an effort to have that happen in the Roman Catholic Church, and it's getting some attention beyond that, I mean quite a bit of attention. But for example, the Roman Catholic Church has now instructed all of the dioceses of the Roman Catholic Church to study the documents. And in Washington, the diocese had a day-long event. There were speakers and there were organization of the folks into study groups, etc. So, and beyond that now is writing curricula for the whole church to work from this document. That means that that's an ongoing, long-term process.
And so one must
begin somewhere. There's a rather vivid scene, and this just underlines the need that you're pointing to, not a solution. Rather vivid scene in the book, Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed. It's a book about how a community in southern France protected Jews during the Second World War. Neighboring communities did not. They smuggled them out. And a Jewish philosopher studying the Holocaust read a little account about the village of Le Chambon and woke up in the middle of the night with tears running down his face. He couldn't answer the question how goodness happened there. So he decided to go find out how goodness happened in Le Chambon. And he went there and found out that it was a group of Huguenots, French Protestants, who had a history of suffering themselves in religious persecution, had kept together as a community, and because they knew the suffering in their own ranks, took in Jews as a perfectly natural thing to do. They couldn't think of doing otherwise. despite the fact that it meant keeping the secret police out and the Vichy government off their necks, etc., and all sorts of interesting things. Well, there's a scene in there in which one of the folks, leaders of the community, is challenged by the author, Philip Holley, and said, now, do you think your nonviolent means would work in lots of other places? And name some of them. And the response is, no, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work in Russia today. It takes some couple of centuries. The point is, there was a community that showed that it worked, but slow education, training, a way of peace that takes a long time. And I think where we're caught is between the immediacy of having massive arms on our hands and at the same time the need for changing our way of doing and seeing and being, and that, the latter, takes long-term commitments as well as short-term. There are lots of things to be done, but you do have to get a commitment on the part of folks to start and to stay with it a while.